Welcome to Opening Stage VGH, the video game history podcast for everyone. I'm your host, Dean Beaver, and I'm once again joined by my lovely wife, Meredith.
Heyo!
We have another repeat guest on the show with us today. You may remember him from the EA Sports Curse episode that we did. Sports
Didn't
as
Madden
well.
Just die?
Yeah, Madden just died.
So this is kind of like a, almost like a little callback.
He died so that we could do this podcast again. This is why I shouldn't be allowed in public. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Chris Pennant back to the podcast. Chris, thank you so much for joining us.
Yo, it's good to be back. Always good to see you, my man. You know, this place is made of bees. Fucking Rob. Fuck Rob all day.
Fuck that dude.
I'm so happy to be back on.
I don't know if we've ever told Meredith about our whole Rob thing, and I know it's kind of like less funny when you explain the joke, but
isn't it like you like would blame everything on some fictional guy named Rob?
Pretty much, yeah. Chris and I met in college. We met doing a few things. The most centric of this was during, we met on the college improv team, Barbecue Kitten. And the whole thing is we would just try and insert this guy named Rob. And no matter what would happen throughout the course of the scene, Rob would somehow steal our girlfriend.
Every single fucking time.
So yeah, fuck Rob. Fuck that dude.
Worst.
Like, that's a fun theme.
He was like, in my mind, he was like the prototypical Chad. I mean, it could change.
Yeah.
As scenes change, but like, so there would be some where he wore the sweater tied over over his shoulders. There
goes to Princeton or some shit.
Exactly. Yeah. Or he was like a greaser with a Trans Am. But every time.
Every time.
Girlfriend stealing.
God damn it, Rob. But yeah, that's. We would also try and like invent things. I remember one time we tried to like have a scene where we tried to invent like a mouse trap on wheels.
Was it supposed to chase the mice?
I think it was like if the mouse was like all the way over there, you would just like push it.
Like so you would see the mouse and shove a mouse trap at it.
A mobile mouse trap, yes.
If you think about it, like, we're putting so much garbage in places that the garbage is overflowing. The mice and rats are just going to get bigger, so using the conventional mousetraps that we have right now won't work, so we need bigger and more mobile mousetraps.
Yeah, we need to be thinking towards the future of mouse warfare.
Mm-hmm. All right, so Dean, applying that logic, how would you deal with the rats in Tennessee that we have those gigantic traps for now that somehow escape them occasionally?
What we need to do is vote them out of office. I mean, I don't know. Good old nail bat is just as good as anything else. But anyway, I digress. We are on a little bit of a time schedule today, so I want to go ahead and get right into the episode. Chris, you know the deal. I've got this boring old book report that I wrote on my phone that I'm reading. If you have any questions whatsoever at any point throughout me reading it, feel free to stop me, interrupt me, and it'll be great.
Because we make it funny.
Yeah. That being said, let's get right to it. Yasunori Mitsuda was born on January 21st, 1972 in Tokuyama, Japan.
I do have to say, I have always like slightly admired how you pronounce Japanese names correctly.
I do my best. I'm not going to pretend to be any kind of expert on the subject, but on a side note, I was like, we're short on time. So let's jump right in. I'm already going to derail this podcast. I listened to another podcast where they play a lot of video game music, and they say a lot of Japanese names. And there's one episode where like one of the guys is like, I'm getting a lot of flack for the way I pronounce Japanese names, so I'm going to try really hard to pronounce them the way that they should be pronounced. And that includes like no stress on any of the syllables. Everything is equal. So he tried to do that. And halfway through the episode, he gives up and he's just like, you know what? I'm just going to say it the way I want to say it. Because you know what? Like if I was French and I was trying to speak English, you wouldn't be like, oh, I am going to have a baguette and a croissant with my friend Brian Wilson.
Got a point.
So he's like, I'm just going to do the best that I can and we'll go from there. Anyway, he took piano lessons until age 16, when he grew more interested in professional sports and aspired to become a professional golfer. It wasn't until high school that Mitsuda rediscovered music, notably Vangelis's score for the movie Blade Runner, and Henry Mancini's The Pink Panther.
Didn't Vangelis also do Chariots of Fire?
Yes. Vangelis did a ton of stuff in the 80s.
I learned how to play Chariots of Fire on the piano. I have still never seen the movie. So, hey, they're good. That's all I'm saying.
I mean, that's me with Blade Runner because my mom had this album on CD and I listened to it a lot because that Blade Runner theme is so good. And
I'll have to listen to it.
All of Blade Runner. Oh my God, it's so good.
Oh, it's like super synthy.
That's how I was with Ghostbusters because like my friends, Jamie and Chris, had the Ghostbusters soundtrack and we would like dance to it, but my parents wouldn't let me see it because I don't know. It was PG-13 or something. And I was, of course, not yet 13.
I mean, you've seen Sigourney Weaver in that movie.
I have not seen Ghostbusters
God
ever.
Damn.
Well, Sigourney Weaver is fine.
Oh, yeah, she's fine as fuck. Anyway, after hearing the music of these films, he then decided to become a music composer. He also became interested in computer programming after his father bought him a computer, a rare commodity at the time. He began composing music and programming rudimentary video games using this PC.
As you do.
So I don't want to spoil anything, but Chris, the reason I asked you to be in on this episode was the fact that we met while I at least was going to college for music. And we definitely had musical run-ins. I mean, you were primarily a jazz trombonist.
That's impressive.
I mean, it was college. Like, I studied a lot of that. So I'm not ever going to be like, yeah, you know, I was a musician and I still feel like a musician, which is why it's so important that I just got this trombone again, new trombone.
I feel that, like, you got your arm back.
Yes, you saw that. But I wasn't anything, fantastic. You know, the people who were on campus who went into professional musicians, Doug Stewart, Kyle Mills, those cats are.
Oh, yeah, and definitely. And I'm speaking for myself, but like I think I'm fairly talented as far as music goes, but like I was easily one of the least talented musicians there. So
it's just like you know who you are at a certain, and you can get better, but
oh yeah, definitely.
Like I knew at that point, I was like, this is who I am. I'm enjoying this, but I'm
I feel like there's like a thing with any kind of skill, like talent will take you so far. And the rest is hard work. And it's just like, do you want this to be fun for the rest of your life and mm-hmm. just play around? Or do you want this to be something like go at? Mm-hmm. And I still feel like you're going to get better either way. So if you just go at it for fun, you're going to pick it up every now and then and do whatever. But you may eventually have to eat. And then if you go at it for like, no, this is going to be my thing. That's eventually going to become your job.
Yeah.
I mean, and you're going to get better both ways. One of them you may excel. Anyway, I didn't mean to derail this on my little pep talk about talent and hard work.
We're going to make it.
You're good. You're good. But I wanted to emphasize the fact that, Chris, I wanted you to be in on this episode because we share a musical connection. And there was a long, long time ago where I kind of strong-armed myself onto your podcast. And I played you a video game song that you liked.
Yeah, dude. That was one of like the first episodes I had people on.
So I wanted to bring it back to that.
Cool.
So anyway, Mitsuda graduated high school and went on to study formally at Tokyo's Junior College of Music, despite the institution's low prestige. As most of the faculty were practicing musicians themselves, Mitsuda would accompany them to gigs and set up equipment in exchange for a first-hand look at Japan's music scene. He began an internship with game development studio Wolf Team and studied under fellow composer and musician Matoi Sakuraba. Just a quick little bit about Matoi Sakuraba. I don't know if you guys have ever played the Shining Force games.
No, that'd be a no from me.
That's a no from you all the time. But they're basically fantasy RPGs. They're kind of, they're strategy RPGs. Final Fantasy is more turn-based and it's a little more straightforward, but strategy RPGs are a little bit more intricate in their design. One thing I like about Sakuraba's music is that in a lot of battle music, he'll use use compounds' time signatures to kind of like elevate the unsettlingness of the situation. So like 7 beats per measure or something, just to throw you off a little bit.
I kind of enjoy it when people do that. So. I mean, it stinks to learn, but...
Oh, yeah, definitely. With no clear plans of what to do after graduating, Mitsuda found an advertisement for an open position with Squaresoft, now Square Enix, most notable for developing the Final Fantasy series. After sending in a demo tape with his resume, Mitsuda had a self-proclaimed disastrous interview with veteran composer of the Final Fantasy series, Nobuo Uematsu.
Who Dean got to meet.
I've met Nobuo Uematsu a few times. He's this happy little Japanese man. It's awesome. But anyway, he had an interview with Nobuo Uematsu and sound designer Minoru Akao, where he stated that he had never played many of Squaresoft's biggest games and saw the job only as a stepping stone to other opportunities.
Ooh, that's bold.
Despite this, he was offered the job in April of 1992.
I guess they were hard up.
Or maybe they saw something and they didn't.
Or maybe he blew them all away.
I don't know. I didn't find any information on what was on that demo tape, but...
I mean, he started, like, just kind of, like, making his own video games and shit, like, randomly before he graduated high school.
I don't want to spoil anything, but you're going to find out he's not all talk.
I wondered if this was going to be one of those podcasts where, like, it all led to nothing.
Over the next 2 years, Mitsuda worked more as a sound engineer, creating sound effects rather than music. Realizing that drastic action would be necessary to advance his career, Mitsuda arranged a meeting with Square's vice president, Hironobu Sakaguchi, with an ultimatum.
Ooh.
Let me compose music for a game or I quit. Sakaguchi relented and assigned him as chief composer for a game called Chrono Trigger.
Heard this story before.
A game that Squaresoft didn't feel would perform well in the West. Sakaguchi allegedly told him, after you finish it, maybe your salary will go up.
What? Who is this dude? He's talking all this shit.
This guy is awesome. A brief summary of Chrono Trigger. At the Millennial Fair, a youth named Chrono and a disguised princess are thrown 400 years into the past.
This is in the game, right? Not in real, in Japan.
Yeah. Okay. No, this really happened.
This is actually the plot of Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles 3, Turtles in Time.
God damn it. One, that was the fourth Ninja Turtles game. Two.
Oh, shit. I was thinking of the,
and we just ate pizza.
Did it look as good as it does on Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles?
It looked better. Show? I'm going to be real. I always thought their cheese was a little slidey.
Oh, yeah. Anyway, a youth named Chrono and a disguised princess are thrown 400 years into the past. This leads to a trip to the distant future, where the party learns of Lavos, a parasitic alien who lives deep within the Earth's core and unleashes the apocalypse in the year 1999.
Okay. All right. A parasitic alien that lives on Earth.
Mm-hmm.
When did he get there?
According to the game, in the year 65 million BC.
So he's been there for a while.
Yeah. You know the meteor that killed the dinosaurs?
Is he not an Earthling at this point?
I'm going to say no, just because he's an organism that didn't originate on Earth.
Did any of us actually originate on Earth when you go back a certain amount of billion years?
The game's sequel actually delves into that.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
That's kind of fun.
Anyway, it's all really hard to follow. And you have to kind of dig for it. But anyway, the party travels through various epochs, from prehistory to the end of time, to find out how to stop Lavos and ensure humanity's survival. The game was designed by the aforementioned Hironobu Sakaguchi, who created the Final Fantasy series, and featured a script by director Masato Kato, who directed Ninja Gaiden's iconic cutscenes, and character designs by Akira Toriyama, creator of Dragon Ball Z. Meredith.
I'm not a fan.
Meredith does not like Dragon Ball Z.
All right, I will do Dragon Ball Z for you, the whole thing, in 2 seconds.
You know, that's really more of a grunt. It's really more full-on screams.
I didn't want to blow out the mics.
You know what? I don't know if I've told you my Dragon Ball Z story, why I don't like it, because it's somewhat similar, but that is not a bad summarization of
Thank you.
No, please do.
In fifth grade, my man Tim Soteris invited me over to his house to watch Goku become Super Saiyan because it was happening that day.
And it took you like the entire episode?
We watched the whole episode. And all this man did was dodge a few punches. And then everybody talked about, oh my God, his power level is up and his instincts are even better. And they just showed the marks of his feet moving because it looked like he didn't move. And I'm like, man, that was dope. Because I had no cable, and so I hadn't seen anything. I just heard people talk about it, because that's what life was like back in 1998.
Oh.
Oh, man. So we were there and watching this whole thing for a half hour, and then the episode was over, and I'm like, wait a second. Because I think at that point I knew what it meant. Like, I was waiting for his hair to go blonde.
Right.
Everything to go nuts. And then now the episode ended, and I was like, are you kidding me? Like, you and got you me like, over here.
And you felt like the kid on the Christmas Story when he was like, a crummy commercial? And he walked out of the room.
No, it's like that times 10.
Bank robbery, dude. And I was like, I'm never watching this again. The only reason that I have any compulsion to watch is because of DJ Meechy Meech, who, if you look him up on YouTube, just does voiceovers for sports, but he evidently likes Dragon Ball Z and has turned the NBA into Basketball Z. And it is hilarious. And that's the only reason that I'm like, I kind of want to watch Dragon Ball Z.
Dean,
and that's not enough yet.
Dean, tell him what you did to your office people.
Oh.
Notice I said did too.
So I get this email that says, hey, we're going to do a white elephant gift exchange for Christmas. And I don't know about everybody else. I guess there's varying degrees of rules for a white elephant gift exchange. I was under the impression that you're kind of supposed to get a somewhat bad gift. So I bought season one of Dragon Ball Z, and that was my gift. And my boss opened it and said, God damn it, Dean.
Didn't even have to wonder who it came from.
I like the show. I know it's not for everybody. I know I've explained this a million times to people, but the problem, Dragon Ball Z has infamous problems with pacing because the comic book was only out for about a year before they decided to start making television show for it. And so eventually the show caught up to the comic book. So they were splitting up one issue of the comic book into three different episodes of the show just to give the guy enough time to ride it out and finish it.
They didn't decide to do a Game of Thrones and just go their own way.
No, they didn't. And look how that turned out.
Well, I've never watched Game of Thrones, but I know people were very passionate.
Yeah. Anyway, going back to Yasunori Mitsuda.
Oh yeah, that guy.
According to Mitsuda, he had difficulty starting the process of writing Chrono Trigger's music and, quote, must have tried to write the music four times, end quote, over a month and a half period. Over the next few months, Mitsuda composed 54 tracks, as well as at least two tracks that ended up not being used in the initial release. He worked to the point of exhaustion, frequently working until he passed out, sleeping overnight in the studio, and then composing on themes based on those he heard in his dreams.
I've done that before.
Eventually, he had to be hospitalized after developing stomach ulcers.
I did not do that.
Uematsu stepped in following Mitsuda's hospitalization, composing 9 tracks and arranging the remaining one, which had been composed by Noriko Matsueda. Mitsuda returned in time to attend a party to celebrate the game's completion, where the game's ending was shown, which reportedly brought Mitsuda to tears.
Aww.
Chrono Trigger's soundtrack proved an incredible success for Mitsuda and Squaresoft. To this day, the game is considered one of the greatest ever made, one of the most cited reasons being its soundtrack. Mitsuda would later remark on the game, saying, I wanted to create music that wouldn't fit into any established genre. Music of an imaginary world. The game's director was a close friend, so I'd always talk with him about the setting and scene before going into writing. So Another thing that brought this episode about, Meredith, during the recording of the last episode, the one that we did about All Your Base Are Belong to Us, you asked me how important a game's soundtrack was to the game. So that's when I decided to start writing this. I've lined up a few selections from the game.
Are you saying I'm your inspiration?
You're always my inspiration. So bear with me.
Ooh, he's screen sharing. Home Improvement. What?
Hold up.
That was a different episode.
Hold up.
Did you not know, Chris, that Home Improvement was a video game?
Oh, shit.
No.
Yeah, you should listen to that episode because it's bonkers.
Okay.
That is actually a really good episode.
Brian Zinda's on it.
No, that's Josh Zagorin.
Oh, right. Josh Zagorin.
Brian Zinda's on our episode about All Your Base Are Belong to Us.
Right. Josh. That was a good episode, though, because we just geek out about the 90s. So many 90s references.
So I wanted to start this off with something that was very, very slightly familiar to us here on the podcast. So I wanted to give you guys a frame of reference because I realize that not everybody is as into Super Nintendo music as I am. So I wanted to give you guys a frame of reference of like typical video game music. So I have here the theme song from Home Improvement, Power Tool Pursuit.
And those of typical?
You well, I chose this one because it was kind of bad. I'm going to tell you that right now. Don't have a whole lot of hope for this one. But fun fact, the original song's real name is Iron John's Rock, and it's composed by Dan Foliart, and it was arranged for the Super Nintendo by Jim Wallace and Steve Malillo. Ladies and gentlemen, please enjoy the title screen for Home Improvement Power Tool Pursuit.
Were they trying to do like the sitcom song into, yeah.
Yep.
I mean, I guess I get it. Because presumably you wouldn't be playing this if you weren't a fan of the sitcom. So you're hoping to hear the sitcom. But I feel like you're like unfairly highlighting Chrono Trigger.
Okay, so that was the
Chris
theme
is shaking
song
his
from
head.
Home Improvement.
No, that was fire.
I mean, I don't mean any disrespect to the people who worked on this game, but it does sound kind of like the Home Improvement theme ran out of money.
I can see that.
So anyway, we will move on to the next song. And I am setting this up a little bit unfairly. Meredith is right. But I just want you to know that this is the range that we're dealing with. Next, we have the overall theme for Chrono Trigger. Again, composed and arranged for the Super Nintendo by Yasunori Mitsuda.
Long.
No, you can't end like that. They ended like that.
They ended like that.
Come on, man. That is a typical composer thing. All the stuff that you would like sing or play in middle school that would just go out and like it would have a what did they call it? It's been so long since I've been in music. Where you have like a one note lead in, and so the last measure is like three notes instead of four because of that. And they would also they would always end you on a short measure and like just left with nothing.
You can't have that anymore.
Dude, they built up so high. They didn't come back to the original theme. You know what? I'm mad that was good.
And that's why they invented the fade out in the 80s.
Yo, I love fade.
No. But yeah, like I said, it's a little unfair of me to compare the first two songs. They are both technically titled themes, but one is this big sweeping heroic fanfare about a story of like zipping back and forth through time. And the other is a theme song about an American sitcom about navigating life in the suburbs with your family.
Except the sitcom, the video game is actually about him fighting monsters on the set of Home Improvement.
No, that's the game of Home Improvement. It's a terrible Super Nintendo game where you go to other sound stages. So like Tim Taylor has to fight like robots and dinosaurs.
Because those are on sound stages.
Yeah. I did want to highlight the, like, he did all of that himself. He had to program it. He had to compose it, like everything from start to finish. And it's like night and day how much. And also the Square probably had a lot more money than the people who developed Power Tool Pursuit did. But there's a lot of great music in this.
Didn't we have some of this music in our wedding?
No, we did have music from the same person composed, but it's from another game.
Oh.
So you're very, it's actually the sequel to this game.
Okay.
Anyway, it's the same guy. But let's move on to the next song. Meredith, I think you're really going to like this one. One thing that Matsuda really likes is kind of combining Celtic and Indian themes.
Indian like Native American or Indian like from India?
From India.
Okay.
So this next song, it's called Corridors of Time. And I think Meredith, you'll really like this one.
You've played this for me before. I have the non-Nintendo version of this. I think you put it on a playlist. Like the nice one where it sounds like with real instruments.
Okay, we're not talking about that version.
All right, I do like that one.
That is Corridors of Time by Yasunori Mitsuda.
Nice.
It's 15 minutes long.
No, that's just the... I wanted this to play, to peel back the curtain a little bit. I wanted it to play a little bit in the background while we talked about it. So that I could pretend to be professional about this kind of thing. But yeah, what do you guys think?
I mean, I like it. The whole thing about these games back in the day is that it was just that time where you didn't have anything that you could turn to. Like, you couldn't turn to your phone. There was media on that. So this was like the media you had other than the TV and the newspaper and your books or your window. if you had a window with something good. So when you had these themes, they would just, you know, like, I'm sorry, let me back up so I'm not talking like a professor, because I'm not talking to you like students. But the whole fact that these would play throughout the level, ingrain them into your consciousness, that's why Chemical Plant, if I say Chemical Plant Zone, people will immediately start singing it.
Ooh.
And it's different from the way that Tony Hawk games music had that soundtrack, because the soundtrack was dope.
Yeah.
But it was like we brought outside stuff in rather than composing music for the game. Mm-hmm. That was like, we're just going to specially design it for this. So for Tony Hawk, they knew that you were playing a level. So you remember the game, but you don't necessarily associate any particular bit of music with a part in the game unless you gravitated towards something to help you through a specific like task that you were completing.
Oh, yeah.
If you put Chemical Plant Zone on, you're immediately like, son of a bitch, this water's rising. I need to find an air bubble so I don't drown. So I have not played this game, but I'm already like, man, this would be cold for whatever is going on in this game, I bet.
Well, at this point of the game, what happens is you've just had this like giant battle in prehistory against like basically like a T-Rex, and Lavos, the alien that I was talking about earlier, like crashes into Earth. Basically, Lavos is the meteor that killed the dinosaurs. So like it hits the Earth, you go to the crater where he landed and you find this time portal. So you're like, we better go in. So you go in it.
As you do when you find a time portal.
So you go in it and you go to the year 12,000 BC. And you go into this weird building and you get shot up into the sky. And there's this...
I mean, serves you right for jumping into a time portal without looking.
And there's this, like, super advanced... like magical society that's living on this island floating above the Earth. And this is the music that plays there.
Oh, that makes perfect sense.
Yeah, that does make sense.
So. Anyway.
I like that. I think that's dope. Man, like, there's so many games that I didn't play because I didn't have a console, but I actually just saw my godbrother at Thanksgiving, and he was the guy who had the Genesis that I most associate, so I mostly associate Sega Genesis and him and his room with memories of Sonic 2, because that's what he had, and that's what I liked playing. Not the first one, Sonic 2, where you can do the spin dash.
Oh, yeah, that game is awesome, dude.
And then, since he was, like, 14 or 15 at the time, with the smell of pubescent teenage boy. Every time I walked into St. Ignatius locker room, I thought of Sonic 2.
As far as like playing this game goes, it wasn't until the last 10 years or so when it was actually readily available. Like I mentioned earlier, they didn't think this game would do really well in the West, so they didn't make a whole lot of English copies. And on top of that, the game was released, I think, in 1994, 95. The Nintendo 64 was right around the corner, so why are we making video games for this old antiquated console when the Nintendo 64 and the PlayStation are right around the corner?
I didn't realize that this came, because I've heard about Chrono Trigger for a long time. Mm-hmm. But I didn't realize it came out that late, because N64 was 96
or 97.
Yeah, it was about the same time in grade school.
So yeah, this game is very hard to get because it's a really good game and they didn't make a whole lot of it. I was actually looking at them up on copies on eBay recently, and the lower ends I could find were $225.
Do you have one?
No, I don't. Well, I have one of the ports that came out in the last 10 years for the Nintendo DS, but that's about it. So, as I mentioned earlier, Nobuo Uematsu of Final Fantasy fame came in after Yasunori Mitsuda's hospitalization. Basically, he did the music that show up in the prehistory and future areas of the game. And I didn't want to leave him out of this because he deserves some credit too. He put some bangers on this. But I wanted to show how his style was kind of different than Yasunori Mitsuda's. The best way I can kind of put it is Nobuo Uematsu was much better at putting in a soundtrack. And I think Yasunori Mitsudo is trying to do more soundscape, if I can verbalize it. So I got a song of his. It's from the future area. The thing is you get in there and you're like, this place sucks. Lavos now reigns from atop a mountain called Death Peak.
Okay.
And humanity is living in the ruins of...
I like how he went from like the core of the earth to the top of a mountain. Like, he didn't need any transition.
Like lava.
That's yeah. True. Oh, I see what they did there.
Yeah. And I'm not even going to get into the overwhelming amount of Jesus parallels there are in this game. But anyway, this song plays when you get into one of the future domes or the ruins of it, and you find that everybody has no hope about the future. Everything sucks. There's no food at all. So this next song, fairly fittingly, is called People Without Hope.
Okay. All right. Sounds like a cheery one.
So here we go.
Yeah, that's bleak. This is like the video game version of Song of the Volga Boatmen.
I am unfamiliar with that piece of music.
Would you like me to play it for you?
Not until after this recording, please.
You can also Google it.
Yes.
It's not long.
But it may not appear like... right on your first listening, but you can tell there's definitely some stylistic differences between Uematsu and Mitsuda. Uematsu really likes these like really weird jazz chords and plays around in them, and that dirty saxophone that's in there. That's why I really like this piece.
It is sad, though. As it was supposed to be doing.
Indeed.
There's a game that I've seen some, or actually a couple different games. I don't know if they have a genre yet, but they're like kind of fantasy horror thriller, like Limbo. You play Limbo?
And there's this I've heard of it.
Little Nightmares that's very similar. Like, you're a tiny person and the other people around you are gigantic. And you have to find your way out of rooms and escape from these giant horrifying people. But that with real instruments, I feel like that and maybe a stripped down version would be very apropos for either of those games.
Mm-hmm.
I can't really describe it, Meredith. Little Nightmares has an aesthetic similar to Coraline.
I've never seen Coraline.
Take some Tim Burton movies and make them a bit more whimsical.
Okay.
I'm down for a less Tim Burton movie.
Yeah, right?
Because sometimes Tim Burton's a little too Tim Burton, if you catch my drift.
I knew you were going to say that.
I mean...
How did you know?
Sometimes Dean Beaver's a little Dean Beaver-y.
Hey. Just because you said that. Our next song... Our next song is the penultimate boss fight in the game. You've gone to all these different time periods and united all of the people against Lavos. So now you're going and you're going to show them what's what. I like this one because it kind of unifies time, or it kind of unifies music from a bunch of different time periods within the games. You've got like a synth backdrop that's supposed to be from the future, but there's this like tambourine keeping time throughout it, which I think is kind of like the, would be like the present day or the past, and kind of like a folky situation. There's a lot of percussion, which comes from the prehistoric era. So like I said, it's kind of unifying the all of the time periods against Lavos. You'll hear the main motif from the Chrono Trigger theme again, because that's kind of a unifying motif throughout the soundtrack, as well as Lavos's theme, played by a very heavy church organ. But enough talk, let's get to it. Ladies and gentlemen, this is World Revolution, again composed by Yasunori Mitsuda. That is World Revolution.
That's a cool, like, we're united against evil track.
Yeah. I was working on something at work today, and I needed to get it done, like, real fast. So I put this music on, and goddamn.
I don't have anything to add.
You know, I don't know if I do either.
I was thinking about what Chris said about how you play these games and like the songs kind of get like ingrained in you.
Mm-hmm.
And like it, like Dean said, like this song is kind of like ingrained. It's like a big boss fight and like a, you know, end of the world kind of thing. And so he put it on in his headphones to like get shit done.
Yeah, it was in my headphones. Like, I wasn't playing it in the middle of an office. That'd be weird.
I assumed. but thank you for clarifying, I suppose. this does nothing for me. Like, I have never played these games. This all sounds synthy. It sounds like it was made on a Casio keyboard. I appreciate that it wasn't. I appreciate that a lot of hard work and intelligence and talent went into this. But, like, I don't have the emotional connection.
Uh-huh.
And so I'm just like, okay, I can see how this one's a little different than that one. So I kind of almost hate to like add anything to these song ones because I don't feel like, I feel like because I don't have the emotional connection.
Yeah.
It is not like, I can appreciate like, okay, these people only had these notes to work with and these sounds to work with. And they made this out of that. And I'm like, I can appreciate that. But, and this is going to be a crude example, like say you gave me a stick and a bucket, a different stick. And I made like a whole thing about music out of it because that's what I had to work with. Like maybe you'd be like, that was really good because you only had the stick and the bucket and the stick. I never want to hear it again. Does that make sense?
I kind of get you. I mean, the no emotional connection thing, that works because I think, I remember somebody played an artist last year when they came over that they were really about and a lot of people were really about. And I just, I found not a whole lot in it. I can't remember the name of, this is going to bother me.
It was like someone popular right now or something.
Yeah, but not like radio mainstream, just like a very, very niche popular. Like this was a like a particular set of, I think, queer folks really dug this artist. And our friend put this on and I was like, this is all right, you know, but I always equated as like, would I listen to this on the day to day? Probably not.
Oh.
Yeah, I get that. I mean, that's the thing about music is it's such a personal experience that it's almost difficult nowadays to judge it. Like
King on a princess. Sorry.
No, you're good. But it is kind of difficult sometimes to judge it on a case-by-case basis. Following Chrono Trigger, Mitsuda worked as composer on Front Mission, Gun Hazard, this time working alongside Uematsu rather than the latter filling in. Despite this, Mitsuda again worked to exhaustion to the point...
Jesus Christ, dude. Like, get some boundaries. Boundaries.
To the point where Uematsu claimed he was, quote, shitting blood, end quote.
Boundaries.
He would continue to compose for Square until 1998, where he left to become a freelance composer, following up on the threat in his original interview. Even so, he would return from time to time to compose on a freelance basis, including Chrono Trigger's 1999 sequel, Chrono Cross. That game has the song that ended up on Our Wedding, Meredith. Since leaving Square, Mitsuda has continued to compose for video games, anime, and private albums, hopefully in a less self-destructive manner.
Yeah.
Most recently, Mitsuda has reunited with director Masato Kato to compose the main theme for mobile RPG Another Eden, The Cat Beyond Space and Time.
What?
Yeah.
It's about a kitty cat?
Well, you play as this dude in a small town and the town gets attacked and steals your sister. And you like run across this cat that takes you 800 years into the future.
Wow.
But, yeah. That's about as far as I've gotten into the game. He is also set to be a guest composer for Sea of Stars, a retro-inspired RPG to be released in holiday of 2022. When asked about the importance of a soundtrack to a video game, Mitsuda said in a 2008 interview, "I think game music is something that should last with the player. It's interesting because it can't be just some random music, but something that can make its way into the player's heart. In that sense, this not only applies to game music, but I feel very strongly about composing songs that will leave a lasting impression. What I must not forget is that it must be entertaining to those who are listening. I don't think there's much else to it, to be honest. I don't do anything too audacious. So as long as the listeners like it or feel that it's really a great song, then I've done my job." So that is the story of Yasunori Mitsuda.
I think he was correct in what he said.
Indeed. Anyway, yeah, that was the idea. Meredith, you asked about the importance of the soundtrack, so I thought that might be an entertaining story for you.
I liked it. I like, and I like his thing. Like, it has to be entertaining for the person, and it has to be the backdrop for the game. Like, the game is important. Mm-hmm. That's why you're there. But obviously, like, the songs, if they get you there emotionally as well, they add to it, and you may even be able to take a little bit of the game with you outside of the game.
Yeah.
That's a great way to put it.
Thanks.
So that's about all the time that we have for today. Chris and Meredith, thank you again for joining you. I hope you enjoyed my little nerd music fest, but we can start wrapping things up. Chris, do you have anything that you'd like to plug?
Always please, if you like sports, if you like basketball, I do the Skyhook podcast with my man, James Kay. He's freelancing for the Tribune. He's stringing for them right now. But he's one of the hardest working people I've ever met. And he's about as open as it gets about things that are driving him, the things that are hindering him. So support James by supporting the Skyhook. Support women's sports, support women's basketball. And my own podcast, What's Good Radio, is going to have some cool guests upcoming. I talked to Sarah Netsley, who works at Bradley in the communications department, about her career writing romance novels, as well as other things. And we're going to be talking to a lot of different people in the upcoming year, including somebody else who is coming out with a book of, I'm not even going to spoil it, but this person is coming out with a book. We're going to talk to them about that book. You're going to be very, hopefully very pleasantly surprised, and it's going to be super dope, and you should listen. And Chicago's the greatest, and anybody who says different is lying to me.
All right, Meredith, do you have anything that you'd like to plug?
Well, I'm always blogging away at meredithraylyons.com/faster, and I love Chicago 3 months out of the year.
Hey, the weather's changing. It's basically fine.
It's been almost summer here. It was like in the 70s the last couple of days.
They just canceled my flight to Chicago, so...
Just try.
Anyway, there's a number of ways you can reach out to us if you'd like. We have an email address, openingstagevgh@gmail.com. We have a Twitter, which is @stagevgh. And I should probably get to work on that, Instagram and maybe TikTok. We talked about that too. I'm an old man when it comes to social media nowadays. But anyway, Chris, Meredith, thank you again for joining me on today's episode. I hope it was enjoyable. This is once again Opening Stage VGH, the video game history podcast for everyone. Thank you so much for listening. Have a good
one. Thank you. Happy New Year.
All right. I need another drink real quick.
This so, is not a quarantini. This is water.
Hey, you can do whatever you want. I'm not judging. Anyway.
I was going to say, Meredith, what's the... did you make up a drink during quarantine?
I did not. I just drank wine. I mean, we were like, to be honest, like quite broke during the quarantine. So it was like box wine a lot. And like Dean drank some shitty whiskey.
Oh, no, that's right. Yeah, because you became a whiskey connoisseur.
Yeah. Yeah, so I stayed with Jack as my low end, but I drank a lot of boxed wine. It was not a pretty, that quarantine, because I was stressed. I mean, I know everyone was stressed, but like job-wise, it was not pretty.
Yeah, I got lucky, and I know a lot of other people did.
I mean, I'm much better now. Everything's much better now. We definitely are one of those people that came out of the pandemic on the upswing.
Oh, yeah.
But I have a wine club now, and I drink wine out of bottles. So that's fun. But did you make up one?
Well, my quarantine-y drink was Kirkland vodka in this cup.
Ooh, Kirkland vodka.
About like, it took some perfecting because the first time I drank it, I got very hungover the next day. It was on a Thursday.
Oh no.
And we were still working from home. So that was in like March or April of last year. So it was early on. But the right balance is probably about two shots worth of Kirkland vodka. Maybe three. I think you get away with three.
And if you're water. Feeling saucy.
And yeah, and then a lemon juice or a lemon wedge if you want. And so you just have vodka, water, and lemon. That's it.
I heard that the Kirkland vodka, though, is actually some pretty high quality vodka.
It's solid.
Yeah.
It's solid. And I like vodka a lot. So I'm willing to try it. If somebody's like, yo, try this vodka out, I'm like, yeah.
I like vodka in the summer.
I can see that. Although it's hard to drink vodka when it's hot, though.
It is.
Oh, really? I like it, like, with a lemonade.
Oh, that's true.
Like, throw it in a lemonade.
Mm-hmm.
Or that's even, like, every now and then I'll do a very dirty martini.
Oh, the dirtiest.
The dirtiest of martinis.
The dirtiest. The drag that through the mud and the
slime. And I like, okay,
like Judas
on.
From
Stop
from,
it. And I like four olives at least.
That's the thing. I don't like olives.
Dean doesn't either.
They're disgusting grapes.
Ugh.
That's what they are. Prove me wrong.
I tried olives with
hot dick. At me on Twitter.
Talk to him. Mike Harris, I gave in. Mike Harris had some olives at a party and I tried them and it was horrible the next day. It was absolutely horrible.
I wonder if I can still do the Mike Harris laugh.
Oh my God, it's so difficult.
That's it.
Oh man, I haven't heard that in so long. I'm off the screen. Oh shit.
Well, Dean, you should do that. You should do that for bonus material.
Oh, I was thinking about it.
Right now.
I'm gonna text Rachel Baldwin.
All right, are we gonna start the episode though? Because Chris has to go soon.
Mm-hmm. I know, that's why I'm trying to keep it going. All right, we ready to go back in?
Yes.
Chris, you ready?
Let's do it.
All right. Going back in 5, 4, 3,